All right. 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to the Cave of Solitude, recording out of the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I think that's it. Did I get it? Is that right? Oh, close.
Pretty close. You combine fastball special with my show.
3, 2, 1?
Because he counts down.
Oh, you don't count down?
Mm-mm.
What do you do?
I'm going to get this cookie out of my mouth. Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude.
3, 2, 1. Coming at ya. Good day, folks.
There you go. Yeah. There's a little bit of energy. This is the Cave of Solitude. Eric Anthony and that sexy voice you heard, of course.
Co-host.
No longer a guest. Frequent old school guest, now co-host.
Yeah.
Tell me who it is.
Oh, Shane Herron.
How's it going, dude?
Chico Escuela.
Chico Escuela, that's going to be the pen name.
Yeah, it's going to be
the pen name. Or what was the other one?
Fandangle P. Jones.
Email us, text Shane on his Instagram or Facebook, tell him which one you want.
Fandangle P. Jones or Chico Escuela? What's a better pen name for me for a fake a pen name?
Which one do you hope they is chosen? If it was, if it is it voted on,
I don't care. I want the people to speak.
I like Chico.
Chico's funny,
but it'll look good on a banner too. Are you Chico? Imagine people coming to your table. Are you Chico Escuela?
Yeah.
Fandangle
P. Jones is way more subtle funny.
It is.
Because you're like, is that a real name? Is that like a porn star name? It's like kind of sounds weird.
Chico Escuela sounds like that too, though.
Yeah. But Chico Escuela was a real guy. Well, a real fake guy.
And you just came up with Fandangle.
Yeah.
What's your favorite pen name of people who are in the business that you know is their pen name? Because I don't know some people like...
Oh.
Chip Zdarsky's a pen name. That's a good one.
Because
it sounds like it's... somewhat real. Like, Zdarsky sounds like a real last name.
Yeah, but who names their kid Chip? But Chip Zdarsky fits him perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, with his sense of humor, like
a guy
named Chip. I don't know, I'm trying to think of...
You got Jim Zub. It's not, Zub is not his full last name. It's like a shortened version.
It's like a shortened version. What are other pen names that we know of, like, people? I'm trying to think. I feel like... as soon as we stop recording, I'll remember.
All of them will come out.
Yeah, I don't know. Who cares?
How's it going? What's new and exciting in your life? You got a couple things shaking up. I apologize. I'm finishing a cookie. It's delicious.
Eric just ate 4 cookies and didn't share them at all with me.
That's a lie.
Freshly baked them.
I freshly baked them. I made enough for me and Shane.
I tried to grab one. He slapped my hand.
But because there's chocolate chips, Shane the vegan won't have the chocolate.
That's not why.
Well, you'd have chocolate?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not the end of the world to eat a chocolate chip.
I agree.
I didn't want to eat them because I'm fat and I need to not eat cookies so much.
Well, I'm not the skinniest guy myself, but I have cookies all the time.
All right, well.
I want someone to join me.
Yeah, I was like, you know what, I shouldn't eat cookies right now for no reason at all.
I guess. Fair enough. So what's going on, dude? It's 1 week past Fan Expo. How was your Fan Expo this year?
Fan Expo
at the Raid table as a pro.
In the corner of the Raid Studios with a banner that didn't match the rest of the guys.
I like that.
I hated it. I didn't realize everyone was... I knew some of them were getting new banners, but I didn't realize there was going to be like a uniform look.
But you and Gibson both had like somewhat different than everybody.
But Gibson's at least had Raid. But Gibson's wasn't white the way like they have that uniform look.
Right.
Anyway, I'm going to get a new one and it's going to be Morris and it's going to say Shane and Raid.
All right. Well, how was the show sitting at the Raid table this year? It's different from Artist Alley. Now, do you miss Ricky?
Nope. No.
Okay.
No, not at all. I mean, I still saw him. He stayed at my house for the weekend. So.
We love you, Ricky.
Yeah. I saw him with his sleep apnea machine, resting very well.
Yeah.
Looked like he was enjoying life.
He says he's almost ready to take over the world.
Yeah, he's like sleeps properly now. He has more energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's looking good too.
He looks amazing.
He's fantastic.
I didn't miss sitting with Ricky. I mean, I like sitting with Ricky, don't get me wrong, but I like not paying for a table. That's really good.
Right.
It makes a huge difference, I think, for me in a sense, because I'm sorry, but like the Fan Expo tables are very expensive in Artist Alley these days. Like you're looking at, I think it's like $600 $600+ to like get an Artist Alley table. So if you're splitting that, you're like,
and how what is the table when you say $600 for a table? How much space is that actually?
6 foot table. Six foot table. Two chairs, two passes. Yeah, essentially, yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
Which is, I mean, you make money at the show, so don't get me wrong, but that's still a lot of overhead to start with, you know what I mean?
And you would split that with Ricky. That
yeah, so we'd end up paying like 300 something each.
With a pass?
Yeah. But you, like, again, you make a lot of money at the show. You make a good chunk of change, but you still have, that's 300 bucks you're spending to just be there. And if, I know a lot of people that don't have good shows sometimes, and like, you're just eating money, right?
Yeah, anyway, for sure.
I find, like, the last show they gave me a guest table, this show they gave me a guest table, I'm way more relaxed. I don't feel the pressure of trying to, like, make money because, like, I don't know. It's just, like, it's a weekend where if you relax a little bit, you sell a bit better, too. And I don't know. It was really nice, actually.
So, yeah, did you find that there was more traffic interest generated being in that pathway that kind of is where, like, you're across from Tim Sale? This year,
yeah, yeah,
which is pretty cool.
I don't think that helped that much for us because I found like the guys across from us were like Dave Finch, Jason Fabok, Tim Sale, Klaus Janson, like these legendary guys. And I feel like those guys go there for those guys, like sure. the people that you know they're not really looking for. They might maybe hit up a Ramon Perez or something, but they're not going to be that too interested in a guy like me. But yeah, I thought like we had a really good spot. But every time I noticed the whole weekend, it was like the other end seemed to be a lot busier the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely thought it was a bit more relaxed, this Fan Expo, like
yeah.
in terms of the amount of people. But overall, like I did a ton of commissions the whole weekend. I was mostly sold art and did commissions the whole weekend, which is not something that is usually, like I usually sell a lot more books.
Mm-hmm.
Sold some books, but not like the majority of my money was coming from doing commissions this weekend, which is really good.
Do you enjoy that? Like,
not usually.
Does it feel like work? Like, oh God, I gotta draw
yes,
again and
usually.
Make sure this is done.
Usually.
Uh-huh.
But I've been doing a lot of, like, I just draw Simpsons characters just for fun because
right.
I like them and, like, put my own little spin on the Simpsons character. And Mike Ruth has a friend who loves the Simpsons. And at the last show, he bought all the Simpsons I had and then commissioned me for another one. And then at this show, he did it again. He commissioned me for two. And then some other guy was at Mike's table and saw them, and then he came over and commissioned me for two more.
I think I was there for that guy.
Yeah, and they were all really nice. And it was, like, I find with the Simpsons characters, I guess because they're really easy to draw for me, and, like, mm-hmm. kind of, it's fun drawing a character that I, like, some obscure side character that I have, like a Hank Scorpio or something like that. So, yeah, I'm actually more relaxed doing it, and I just didn't really have a lot of pressure, so it was good. Most of my commissions I'm not happy with. This one, I think I was happy with most of them.
I gotta say, it wouldn't have been my choice had I, because when you did a commission for me, the first one you ever did, and it's one of the nicest ones in my book, the yeah. Hellboy that you did.
But that's because it's right after, like, Mike Ruth's, like, Thor or something, isn't it? So I remember seeing that and being like, oh, I better do a good job.
Yeah,
like,
but every time I look at it, I'm like, that's a dope Hellboy. And I'm not a guy that was a Hellboy fan. And And I look at it and I'm like, that's pretty damn cool.
Does it make you want to read Hellboy?
It does.
Oh, all right.
I actually bought a couple off of Comixology. They had the omnibus thing for Hellboy.
You should get one. There's one trade. It's called Hellboy Weird Tales. And it's all done by, each story is done by different artists. And there's like really cool different takes on him.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me about that one.
That one's one of the best books.
So sometimes someone giving you that one commission or that obscure commission you never really thought to have.
I didn't realize that you weren't a Hellboy fan. I just assumed everyone is.
Yeah.
Because you said draw, like, whatever, I think.
I said draw whatever it is you have fun drawing. Because usually that's when the artist will give you the best that they got, right? When they have fun doing it, too. Because you could go to somebody and be like, I want, you know, Green Goblin, and the person hates Spider-Man.
Yeah,
and it's
going
to look like crap.
Yeah, I did my first Laura Croft at this convention.
How did that go?
I think it turned out really good, actually. I did it, not in full color, but, like, ink washes. I thought I did pretty good, actually. I thought it turned out really good.
Is there any commissions that you hear just like, oh, God, not this again?
No, I don't think so. I don't know.
You're always up for the challenge?
I try to talk people. When people want something that I'm not really into, I usually try to, like, talk them into getting something else or Or sometimes, like, I don't know, I'm not, like, I usually take any kind of commission, for, even if I don't know the character, but, like, sometimes if it's something I really don't want to do, I'll just, like, sort of be like, you should go to this artist.
What's been that one that you really didn't want to do?
Not at a show, but I remember there was this girl, she's like a fitness bodybuilder girl who, like, hit me up on Instagram last year, and she wanted a drawing of her and her boyfriend, who's, like, a big bodybuilder guy.
Yeah.
Like, a portrait of them as superheroes. And I was just like, I don't know, I just wasn't really into it. And I was like, I could do it, because she was willing to pay good money. And I was like, I could just do it for the money. But I just didn't really want to do it. And I was busy, and I was like, I don't know. So I'll usually ask around to other artists I know who are taking commissions to see if they're interested or if they're the right fit. And Casey Parsons, I sent it to him, and he actually, like, he drew her as Elektra and the boyfriend as Daredevil. And like,
that's dope.
It actually, he knocked it out of the park, actually. He killed it. So I was like, I feel like that was a good win-win for everyone. I didn't want to do it. Pass it along to Casey, who did a way better job, and they were super happy with it. So, yeah. But in general, like, I don't know. Yeah, I just try to, if it's something I don't want to do, I usually charge way more, hoping they'll say no.
When people ask me to change something in their house plumbing-wise, mm-hmm. I usually just like, yeah, it's going to cost this much much.
And if they're insistent, then you're like, it's worth it.
Yeah.
But I don't like doing commissions where I have no love for the drawing, so...
For sure.
If I can always pass it on to, like, my roommate, Chris Yao, former guest of this show, I've given him tons of commission work that... Because he's always up for anything, and he's more versatile than me, and if he could use the commission, and I'm not really into it, and pass it along, right?
What's the weirdest commission that you've been asked? I always hear about artists saying that guy with the... women dripping in glue.
Never met the glue guy, but I've heard about the glue guy. I don't think I've ever had anything too weird. I had one time, it was a guy, he was really nice, and he asked me to draw, like, in his book, and he wanted to draw like this raccoon character I used to draw in one of my other books. And then I was like, hey, do you mind if I flip through your sketchbook? Because I just like to see what other artists did. And there was a lot of sort of like anthropomorphic animals doing sexual things.
Yeah.
Which is not my thing. And it's not what he asked for. He just asked for me to draw, like, the raccoon character. So I was just like, but I'm not, like, offended by it. I wasn't just like, I was like, whatever you're into, right? That's your thing. But I did it for him, and he paid, and it was all good and everything like that. But I was just like, yeah, I just drew the regular raccoon. Like, I didn't draw a dick or anything like that or whatever. And he was just like, he was actually super nice and polite. So it wasn't even really a bad experience. But I was like, I don't know if he expects me to draw something sexual, but I'm not going to go the sexual route with animal stuff. I feel that's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah. Some of the things people come up with are the thing, because a lot of people's sketchbooks are themed.
Yeah.
And then you, like, I remember I don't know if it was Fan Expo last year. It might have been last year's Fan Expo, but Casey was having to do something like that with two girls. It was like...
Oh, Catwoman.
Catwoman, something like that. And it was
pretty... not like Batman Catwoman. Like, yeah. Legit, like...
Cats.
Island of Dr. Moreau, like, yeah, Catwoman.
Something like that.
I'm going to see if we can find... I just remembered one. It's not really that weird. It was actually kind of fun. It was this guy who wanted me to draw him getting ripped in half by an alien. And I usually don't do likeness stuff because I'm not that good at it. But it actually turned out really good, and he loved it. Like,
oh, that's hilarious!
Yeah, just like ripping his body in two.
What's it? Most artists, when fans come to the show, how many people say, "Can you draw me?" How often does that happen?
A lot.
You draw? Yeah. Is that weird?
Yeah, because I don't like drawing people. I don't like drawing actual people, especially on the spot at a Fan Expo. I'm not good at likenesses of people. If it's the right fit and I'm home, I can, like, do it, take my time and really get it right.
Right.
But overall, I don't like doing likenesses of people. Some people are really good at it. Like Mike Ruth is, like, incredible at that stuff. Casey Parsons is really good at that stuff. Not my thing usually, but, yeah, I find people that are not really into the comic book scene, like, a guy like you knows what you're getting when you go to an artist. They want you to, you know, draw Captain America or something like that.
Right.
But I think there's people that show up at cons that have never been there before, and they're like, ooh, sketches, oh, draw me. And they think we're like caricature artists.
Right.
And it's like a carnival or something like that. So you get a lot of that. I also found that it's weird. Like, one year I priced my sketch list as head sketch and full body. And for some reason, people kept seeing head sketch thinking it meant, like, I'll draw their head. And like they didn't really understand what I was... I think I changed it now. I kind of word it so it's, like bust or, like, a head...
Character bust.
Yeah, yeah, something. I word it differently so it doesn't seem like... Because I'm, like, everyone, like, a lot of people kept coming up being like, oh, okay, you'll sketch my head? And I was like, oh, no, I didn't mean, like, you, but, like... I mean, if that's what you really want... Like, I don't want to turn down a commission, but also, I don't really want to draw your head. Like,
I've never thought of... characters to get for head sketches, just because in order to do it, you got one, you have to one get a very specific looking character, otherwise I just want like as much of the like a body of the character.
I'll usually do like a bust,
so yeah, it's like at least the top
half, the chest, right? Shoulders, something like that. And then I mean, I don't know, sometimes I'll go a little crazy if it's like a character I really like anyways, and mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like when you're drawing Hellboy, part of the fun is drawing like his right-handed Doom, right?
So yeah,
it's like,
you have to. Yeah,
it's not
yeah,
as fun, yeah. But he has a very interesting face too at the same time.
That's
right?
True,
but,
yeah, it's very unique.
Yeah, I don't know.
I've never gotten somebody to draw my likeness except twice, and that was you. You're the only person.
I did it twice?
You put me in the Morris comic, and you drew the album cover.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
so I was
going
to say to myself, I never want my likeness, but you're the one person who's had to draw me twice.
Well, in the book.
That's hilarious.
In Morris, like, if people don't know, we had on the Kickstarter tier, you could buy a spot where you're an extra in the saloon.
Right.
And Martin and Eric did it, and my friend Mike did it. And then that was okay. And then, I did your album cover. But you wanted me to draw you guys sort of like peanut characters.
Yeah,
it's different when it's doing like really cartoony or stylized. Yeah. So that's like me just trying to do a version of you that's like a Charles Schulz drawing.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not really my style anyways. I'm like aping Charles Schulz. But
yeah
that was still actually, they turned out pretty good.
That was great. Yeah. So let's talk about Cauldron. That's another new thing that's happening.
Let's talk about it.
It's volume 3. Is that how we're...
No, like it's, we just call the... We say between ourselves like the third issue, but...
The third issue.
We're not trying to sell it as the third issue, because I find when you get too high in numbers, like when we get to issue 7...
People are going to be like, I got to go to issue one
first.
Yeah,
so, but you don't... We do magazine style, so it's... This is fall 2019.
Got it.
First issue was fall 2018. Last issue was spring 2019.
Okay.
And this is fall 2019. Just so it's just, it seems like more disposable. I'm just pulling up because we're going to talk about it. I asked Sam to send me a list of all the creators in the book so I could try and get all their names right. Because there's people that... Oh, here we go. Okay. Yeah, okay. So... Today is, what's today, the 2nd of September?
Today is Labor Day as we record this.
And the plan is we're launching tomorrow, Tuesday, maybe Wednesday. We'll see what happens.
Stay tuned throughout the week on your social media feeds and Kickstarter.
But yeah, we're launching, if you want to search for it, it's Cauldron, Fall 2019. It'll come up. It has a cool cover by Casey Parsons with a big clawed monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a cave and then a little like barbarian and a barbarianess. What do you call a female barbarian?
I don't know.
Two barbarians. One male, one's a female.
Two barbarians.
It's two barbarians. It's them looking, again, we got him to try and ape like a Frazetta look. And
right.
He killed it. It looks
great.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
Yeah. Casey's killing it right now. And I think I go on a limb to say that the first Cauldron... the fall 2018, was it?
Yeah.
I think that kickstarted, no pun intended,
Casey fever?
A little bit. I think it kind of put him, I wouldn't say put him on the map, because even his Morris cover, the variant cover that he did for you, was gorgeous. It's like he's always been good. But sometimes you just need that thing to just push you into the pool.
I think so, and I think he would agree that that's sort of like, because... I don't know if you ever read his original book that he did called Blood Moon.
No.
I've seen it,
but I haven't read it.
Well, it's not very good. And he'll admit that, too. And so we met Casey. We just met him as like, oh, he's like a guy that went to school with like Mike Ruth. And he does art sometimes. And he gave us a copy of Blood Moon. And I remember reading it and being like, I don't really care for this. Like, he told me, too. He was trying to... His background is fine art and painting. And he was trying to just draw comic books the way he thinks comic books are supposed to be. And then when he finally got to do the Cauldron pages, we let him do whatever he wants. And he just does this, like, sort of layout without borders and paints and creates the page and lets the fine art tell the story, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when he did the Cauldron one, he sort of was, like, himself figuring out, like, oh, this is how I want to do comics. I don't have to do it how I think you should do it. I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah.
And then he's been steadily getting better and better. So, yeah, I think you're right. And I think he'd agree with you.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, like, for me, I'm a big believer in the Cauldron product because it's become that place where even established people, it gives them that outlet to do something a little bit fun or off the beaten path that maybe, if they're working professionally for a bigger company,
yeah,
they have to hold themselves back. This one, there's like no limits,
yeah,
in a way. So it seems like the cool thing for the cool kids to try to, everyone like, can I get a part of it? Can I get a part of it?
That's true. Cause we've had a few guys who are, I mean, not huge names, but more established guys who are asking about how they get in Cauldron now, and we're setting things up for the future, so it's actually been really good.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't want to say like names yet because I don't like to. I want to wait till things actually come together because things fall apart easily and stuff too. But we've got some pretty good names working on a bunch of different stories for future issues.
So who's working on this one? What are some of the stuff happening in this issue that we can name?
Let me look at my list.
All right. Yeah, big shout out to Casey. His stuff has been gorgeous. Casey
Parsons.
And I think he's gonna blow up.
He is, man. He's got him and Mike Ruth got the same art dealer. I can't remember the name of their art dealer, but they like take care of all his like art sales. He's been doing good. So he did that cover for what's that book? Little Bird or something like that from Image that they did. And apparently they like flew them out to like Colorado and stuff like that. It was like pretty cool. And then he just went to, I mean, have you had Casey on the show? Not like this, though.
Not one-on-one like this,
though. You should do it with him.
I do want to do it with him,
because he went on an art retreat with a bunch of, like, legendary guys, and, like, Bill Sienkiewicz was there, and they were, like, it was, like a week-long, like, seminar of, like, art classes and stuff. He just went, it's in, like, Kansas City, and it was, like, just, because Sienkiewicz is, like, his hero.
Well, I could see Casey having a career in that vein of him doing pretty much anything that he wants with that art style and some sort of like a graphic novel album kind of thing, the way Sienkiewicz did back in the days with Daredevil and Elektra.
Yeah.
And people would go nuts for it.
Yeah. Or like Dave McKean kind of stuff. For sure. Yeah. If you get him on the show, you should talk to him about that retreat thing he did. It sounds like pretty mind blowing what he went through. Okay. So Casey does our cover. Our back cover is by, and I just realized I've never really said his name. Do you know Paul Limenko? I don't know how you say his last name.
No.
But he's one of the guys who was like part of Spent Pencils. He's just like super talented dude. Actually, I want to try and show you because while we're talking about it, I want to show you his back cover because it was weird. We asked him to do a back cover because Casey was already working on the cover for this. But his stuff is so cover worthy, like he's just incredible. So I just really want to show it to you first because his back cover just fucking blew us away. But it's really good. I'm trying to find it now. Sorry.
It's okay.
But yeah, the back cover is by Paul Limenko.
How did the second run of Cauldron, the spring 2019, compare to what happened prior to it? Did you find that it like gradually more and more interest was gaining with it? Because that one was launched at Comic-Con, Toronto Comic-Con, correct?
Yeah, we had the Kickstarter go in January and then end in time for us to get the money, pay the printing, and have it for the March Comic-Con, yeah.
Yeah.
It grew a little bit. It was... I thought, because our first one we made just about $4,000.
Okay.
And then the second one we made about, I don't know, like $4,500, something like that. Like it was a little bit more. But I thought it was going to blow up a little bit more, but it didn't. But I also think in January, people are a little tighter with their money. They just spent a lot of money at Christmas and stuff like that. So I don't know. But we actually found like each time we made a lot of new fans.
That's,
like,
that's what I mean.
Yeah. And a lot of Americans. A lot of Americans. Like they're 70% of our Cauldron. Like
that's backers. Really interesting.
Yeah. And Sam's actually going to get into like trying to track the like, all the like little
fine hot spots.
Yeah. And see like why. Where they're coming from, where they... But we're just finding a lot of people just discover it through Kickstarter, which is crazy.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know, but...
Is there some sort of in Kickstarter when it comes to, like even, let's say, something like Morris, or in this case, Cauldron, when you hashtag it, is there things that maybe are so-so? If you put, like, horror comics, is that part of the search for... will Cauldron come up?
I don't know. I know that... They feature, like, whenever there's a new thing on Kickstarter, it's like, these are new items that have launched, and they feature those for a bit on that page, and I think there's people that just search that.
Okay.
I think when you're successful right away, and you hit your goal really quickly, they feature it as, like, a projects we love, and stuff like that, and it keeps getting featured more. So I think there's a bunch of different, like, variables and factors, but we also keep trying to work with different creators too, who have a different network. So, you know, guys like Paul, who've never been involved before, he has a huge following. Maybe we'll pick up some fans because they, you know, they saw Paul's cover. They want to back that type of thing, right?
You got the picture?
I can't find it.
Okay.
I can find like a half done finished one.
That's
but,
okay.
I will keep looking for it. I just want to like, also pay attention to what we're talking about.
No, that's fine.
But Paul, yeah. So Paul, he's amazing. I think he's like living in Thailand now, which is frustrating because he's so close before and easier to talk to.
Right.
So one story is called The Keeper by Sam Noir and Locke. And again, sorry. This is a very common Vietnamese last name, which I'm probably butchering, but... Lock Nguyen? Nguyen?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
Like Dustin, Dustin Nguyen, yeah.
Yeah, is that how you say it?
I don't know.
I actually know a lot of people with that last name, and I've never say it, so.
Yeah,
I think it's Nguyen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're doing it justice.
Yeah, so that's, like, that's Sam's story with Locke. It looks really cool. He's got a little, like, tagline, but I'm not going to read that. well, like, for each story, it has a little, like...
Yeah, tell us. Okay. People gotta know what they're buying.
I guess. I don't know. I feel like a salesman.
You are a salesman.
A young girl, so this is called The Keeper, or just called Keeper. A young girl desperately searches an urban wasteland for her sister, praying to save her from mutant slavers. Who will save the young girl from slavers once she finds them? That's what it says.
Dum-dum-dum. Yeah. That doesn't sound so bad.
No, I know. I don't know how to
like it. Yeah, tell us the description.
In a faraway land. and then here's, this is not my story, but this is my portion of the book that I edit, is my story of, it's by Becca Gorefield, who's writing and drawing it, and it's pronounced Ylva, like Y-L-V-A, and I guess I can read this tagline. I don't want to read this tagline.
Why?
I don't know.
Give us the tagline, don't worry.
We call it Lesbian Conan, that's how she pitched it to us, and I was like, yeah. Let's do Lesbian Conan. That sounds great. And if you got the last issue of Cauldron, she did a pinup, which was sort of like a preview of this story in it. And she's just so super talented. Following her wife's brutal murder, the most ruthless barbarian in a war-ravaged land bargains with the gods. Aided by a cunning witch, she storms the underworld, battling hordes of the dead to save her lost lover's soul.
Okay. Yeah. There you go, for the Conan fans.
This is going to be the best.
Yeah, best part of it.
Becca is like this... person you've not heard of who's so talented, everyone's gonna be like, holy shit. And she does everything like digitally painted, it's beautiful.
Okay.
This is our Casey story, by Casey Pierce, written and illustrated by Casey Parsons. It's called Aurora. I don't know anything about it, so we'll just read this. A malevolent evil lies beneath the streets of Rome and in the seats of the Vatican. A savage unholiness that will change the meaning of one young woman's very existence and the world as we know it. So that sounds pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, it looks amazing. I've seen Casey's art for it. It looks incredible. So this is Ricky's portion of the book, which he didn't do anything this time around. He's just editing.
Okay.
The title is Breaks in the Armor, and it's written by Mark Bertolini, which I don't know if you know who he is, but he's like this up-and-coming dude. He's been doing a lot of really cool projects that, like, for smaller publishers lately, but I think he's going places, man. And we sat with him at a table like 5 years ago at a con and got to know him, and then like he's just like always working, always hustling, and just a really good writer. And this one is illustrated by Jerome Aquim. I don't know how to pronounce it. I apologize, Jerome. A broken man must cross over to the dead world in order to become its savior. That's it for that. And then we have, there's two pages of the Dweller and the Cellar, our like Crypt Keeper character. It's drawn and it's written by Sam Noir and it's drawn by Robert Freeman, who did the last one. And he did a story in the first issue, mm-hmm. and he's an incredible artist. And then we have a prose story by Aaron Feldman and a guy named Cardigan. He did an illustration for it. And the story is called Burlap, and it's actually a really creepy, weird story. And I don't know if you guys know Aaron Feldman, but he's one of my favorite writers that I know, and I'm trying to get him in Cauldron, so. That's what we're working on here. That's what we're dealing with.
And how many pages will it be in total once it's all done?
We're not entirely sure at this point. I think it's going to be about, like, very similar to the last issue, which I think was, like, 48. I think it was, like, 48, something like that. But, yeah, there's four full comic stories and then one prose story. So it's got some good... And then bookended with, like, the Dweller pages.
So the Dweller will be at the end of this one instead of the beginning.
I think it's at the beginning and then maybe a page at the end, or maybe okay. It's two pages at the beginning. I don't know.
Okay.
But there's... I think it's two pages of his story. And it features, do you know Dr. Steve-el?
No.
It's a guy named Steve. He cosplays as Dr. Evil at cons.
Okay.
And they call him Dr. Steve-el, and he's become like he has like a YouTube show that he interviews people as Dr. Evil. And in the last Kickstarter, you could buy a tier where you show up in the Dweller story in the next issue, so... Steve-el shows up in this issue, basically, with the Dweller and the Cellar, so it's kind of cool.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
How many pitches did you guys get this time around? Are you getting more and more pitches now that Cauldron is a thing that is reoccurring? People are like, this is coming out again.
We're not getting, like, cold pitches. We're getting just people being like, hey, how do I get in the book?
Okay.
And then, depending on who they are, if I know who they are and I really want to work with them... I try to get them working on something if possible for a future issue, but there's also people that I don't know who've reached out, and I'm hesitant to take pitches at this point because we don't really have a spot for them. Like, I try to be open and honest with everyone. I'm like, we're doing two of these a year. There's few spots. Most of them are already filled by us or so. Like,
right.
Issue, I have a story that I want to draw and do myself, and I'm like, yeah. You know what I mean? But there's so many other people I want to work with. So I'll take some ideas and pitches from people, but I'm not taking too many because we just really don't have the spots for it at this point. Mm-hmm. Unless we expand to get bigger, which I don't want the magazine to get bigger. I want it to stay about the right size, just like...
Well, maybe you'll start making more of them.
Yeah. So there's talk of, like, doing... I would like to do the book quarterly, 4 issues a year, which is a lot more work. But I don't want to do 4 Kickstarters a year, so we're thinking of maybe doing a Kickstarter for 2 issues at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We're figuring out. But right now, we're just sticking to the original plan of just 2 a year.
How I don't know if you guys have a way to measure it, a metric system or anything like that, but how do they move in the stores?
They've been doing pretty good, actually. The problem is we haven't got them in as many stores as we want. We mostly have them in local stores of guys we know.
Right.
But people, like, this is one thing we were talking to a publisher about getting into Diamond with it. And they just were like, with the oversized, like, magazine size, mm-hmm. it's almost like the size of, like, a vinyl album.
Yeah.
He thinks that stores won't order it just because it doesn't fit in a long box. And I'm just like, yeah, but, and he wanted to change the size. And I was like, I was like, all right, maybe I'm not married to the size, but I feel like that's part of its appeal is that old school.
But heavy metal didn't fit in a long box. Yeah. And Savage Sword of Conan and those didn't fit in that, like, they were that size.
I don't know. But we entertained that idea of changing the size, but I'm like, you know what, I like the way it is.
No, I wouldn't change it.
And also, I think we're realizing too that being in Diamond is not what it used to be and maybe is not the right thing for this magazine. Like, obviously it's always good to have wider distribution, but we're selling a lot through Kickstarter. We're selling a lot through our online store. We're selling a lot in person. We're going to explore going into, like, vinyl shops and retro shops and, like, because that's who we appeal to, right? Guys that are a little bit older, who are looking for something that makes them feel, like, nostalgic in a way, but with new material. So, yeah, we're just, like, we've sold some in, like, we've sold a lot at Comic Connection in Oakville. Okay. Where, like, Mike Ruth hangs out there.
Yeah.
The Cauldron guys are pretty good with the owner of that shop. And he's sold, like, quite a bit. And what's it called? Thunderstruck Books across from BMV in Toronto.
Okay.
On Spadina. Used to be the Labyrinth. That was Thunderstruck.
I saw it there. Yeah. I went there a couple of months ago, yeah. And I'm like, oh, look, there's a Cauldron.
Yeah, the owner of the shop who took over and changed it to Thunderstruck from Labyrinth. Her name is Dobby, I think her name is. Really sweet girl. She's bought a bunch. She's usually buys.
Does she work at Labyrinth before?
I believe so.
And she has glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's very nice.
Yeah, I think she was working there, and then when the guy wanted out, she kind of like took it over. I don't know how that worked out, but basically, Thunderstruck is hers now, and we've sold quite a bit there. We did a signing there, and she usually buys 10 at a time off of us, and we go in, and usually there's like two left or something like that. So, yeah, we have them there. I know they're at the Beguiling. I think they're at Silver Snail. But yeah, we're just like, we're moving a little bit in stores. But we're just doing a lot through Kickstarter.
It's a good place to start.
Yeah.
I like to get a gauge of what the response is. And how when someone backs your Kickstarter, you know there's interest.
Yeah.
Which is good. But I think, yeah, seeing it in... That concept of it, the size, I think the size is half of its appeal.
I think so too. That's like
not because the content isn't good, but it stands out on a shelf.
Yeah.
If it's the size of a regular comic book,
and
it doesn't have Image or Dark Horse because it's not obviously DC.
Yep.
People are gonna be like,
It's also so funny too because I was talking to Phil McClory, who is a writer, and him and Brian Avenue started this book called Monstrosity in 2013, 2014, and me, Sam, Ricky, we all had stories in there, but they were the editors of this book. And it was, I think they did two issues of it. And the second one was, I think, like 200 pages plus of like
a digest, quality. Right?
Yeah, like a digest. But they did it in this manga size.
Yeah.
Which is a cool book, you know, pocket reader stuff. But we were selling them for $15. And like, it was so hard to sell them. Because I feel like people, even though there was 200 plus pages of story in this book, people are like, this small little book, it should be worth less. And then we sell Cauldron for $10. And there's way less pages in it. It's like under 50 every time. And I think people, like, just the size of it, I think in people's heads are like bigger.
It's substantial.
It's larger, so it's worth more, right? Which is kind of silly, but I mean, I get that, why people think that way.
But you look at now, too, DC with their Black Label imprint. I don't know if you've seen the size of those books. They're the size of Cauldron. They're you can't put them in a long box.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, more problematic for one of the big two companies to do something like that.
Yeah.
Because they're still floppy.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily... They could go on a bookshelf.
Yeah.
But people put their Superman, Batman issues inside long boxes.
Yeah.
But something like this, that's like a heavy metal style magazine, it has that feel of what you are trying to make it. So I think... That's a whole load of crap. I think if it does go one day into Diamond and people see that this is the new era of what heavy metal once was, this is for a new generation, I think people would jump on it. Especially if you've got people doing covers, like Casey's covers are gorgeous.
Yeah.
And his name will get bigger.
Yeah.
But then if you get like your last issue with Adam Gorham,
this
is an established professional.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've always been like, I've always loved like top shelf books, and theirs always came in huge different sizes, big to small. And I like books. I don't really care. I'll find if I really want it and I like it, I'll find a spot on my shelf for it.
Yeah. Look at these Fantagraphic books.
Yeah.
Like those hip hop, the Ed Piskor books that he's putting out. Like those are awkwardly shaped, but people are crazy for them because they're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's just one publisher we talked to that kind of was they won't order it. And I'm just like, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we'll change the size, but also maybe we'll just keep it the way it is and see what happens. Like, I don't know.
So the story you're editing, how much actual editing did you have to do, or how great was that story? Because you speak pretty highly about lesbian Conan. So what does your editing this time around entail?
Yeah, I don't think I'm that good of an editor, to be honest with you. I'm always just, like, wowed by what everyone does, and, like, it's hard to be, like, constructive sometimes, because I'm just like, oh, this is so good, let's go with it. And then, so, I think this time around we've kind of let the other editors see, like, hey, what do you think of this story, and this, instead of just doing our own little... but no, like, Becca's just so talented, I just want her to, like, get that story out there. I just want more people to see her work. And she's one of the people that I've read her previous work. I really trust her. So I just look at it and I'm like, yeah, this is great. Like, whatever you're doing, just keep doing more of this. I want more of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like a 12-page story, and I think it's all pretty good.
Are all the stories the same length? No.
Okay. No, I think Casey and Casey's is only like 6 or 5.
Okay.
Or it might be 7 now. I think he might have expanded it, but it's shorter than... Because mostly we try to aim for each story to be about 10, give or take a few pages. And some have gone a little longer, some have gone shorter. But 10s are like ideal goal. But we might get into in future issues, like if we have a 4-page story and a 6-page story, put those together, you know, and have a few extra bits of story in there instead of... But I don't want it to be too thick. I want the book to be always less than 50 pages.
Okay.
For some reason. So I feel like that's the right amount of content.
Yeah. I think especially because it's not a... What's the term? Is it glue bound? This is still stapled like a real magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Going more than that, it could be...
Yeah.
I think too hefty and more become more flimsy to keep it in that...
I'm not worried so much about that. What I'm worried about is I buy anthologies and, you know, I have things like Wayward Sisters, Toronto Comics Anthology, the previously mentioned the Monstrosity books. And one thing I find is... and this is not a knock to those books. I feel like there's so much content in each one because they're like a lot more stories.
Volumes.
I feel like when I get those books, I read all the... I go through it and I pick the creators I like or the art that stands out and I try to read those. And then I force myself to go back and... Because I want to read everything thoroughly.
Right.
To feel like I got my value. But there's some stories I don't want to read. Like it feels like a chore sometimes.
Sure. And it's because there's all this space that they... It's almost like they needed to fill it.
No, it's just like there's a story that I'm just not that into. Like, okay, it's not, okay. not necessarily like I don't want to be.
It's
like,
not a knock.
No. I just personally, I'm like, when I get a real thick anthology, I feel like it's sometimes a chore to read every story in it.
Sure, okay.
But I feel like if you give them 3-4 stories, maybe 5 stories at the most, you don't feel, or if you don't read them all, or it's easier to read them all, and if you don't, you don't feel like, I threw away money and I didn't really get the value of it. You know what I mean? Like. Maybe they won't read the prose story. Maybe that's not their thing. But I feel like it's a good amount of value to be like, this is how many stories there is in it.
Okay,
that's my thinking. I know that's what just
no,
my
it's an interesting
I base
take.
That literally personally on when I buy anthologies and try to read the whole thing. And
but
I'm
those other anthologies, I haven't bought a lot except for like the Raid one, which is a beautiful book, and you got a lot of great prose in it, professionals. But those other anthologies that are these thick tomes, volumes, right? I'm sure that they range in genre within the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well, it depends on what anthology you're talking about, right?
Whereas with Cauldron, it's all in that same genre field. So when you do get 4 or 5 different stories, it's not going to be a jarring experience. You'll have, like, ones that are maybe period pieces, like the Conan story that you did.
Yeah.
Not Conan, but that type of feel. And then you'll have... Something that's, you know, like what Sam does with the monsters.
Yeah.
You know, you're in that realm.
Yeah.
So it's got this nice uniformity to it.
I also just, I don't know about everyone else, but I like reading my comics in the tub and on the toilet. And I like to
best
have...
Best place.
I like to, like, I don't want Cauldron to be this thing where it's like, oh, I gotta keep it pristine. I literally think you should sit on the back of your toilet when you go for a poop. You read one of the stories.
Put it in your back pocket
Exactly.
The almanac, like the in Back to the Future.
Exactly. That's what I always think of. I'm like, I like... That's why I keep my anthologies when I buy them. Most of my comic books, I'll keep them by the toilet. I have a little rack in the bathroom, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna read this one while I have a little poop. I read this one while I have a bath.
So note to self, when Shane offers you or me comics, just know that they were in some private moments with him.
That's right.
Or in the tub.
They were in the tub.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
yeah, that's right.
That's hilarious. Do you want something to drink?
I'm okay.
We're good? Okay. I figure we got the bar right here, so we might as well get something to drink if you want. But
the bar?
Well, you know, the kitchen.
You mixing up drinks?
I could if you want to. Yeah.
You gonna make a martini?
So, after Cauldron, we got Morris you're working on.
Yes.
Tell us about this new Morris adventure that we're going to be expecting. Because you say it's going to be, I said too on one of the shows, it's going to be ready for Fan Expo 2020.
It was supposed to be ready for March this year. And then Fan Expo this year, but
But work is your day job.
I was working a day job that was killing me, which I'm not doing anymore. No, it's this one I would like. Now I'm at the point now where I'd like to get it done by the end of the year, and then I'm trying to figure out where I should release it. I wasn't thinking about kickstarting it again, but I might go that route, you know, because I would like to do a nice, like, I don't know, square bound book or something like that. It costs a little bit. I don't know. Try to figure out the details, but I just got to get the book done. But I'm thinking maybe March Comic-Con next year, or I don't know, maybe TCAF. I'm trying to figure out the event. I'd like to get it done before then. I just try to figure out when I want to do it and release it.
Well, Toronto Comic-Con and TCAF aren't too far apart from each other. So if you did it to have that at the Toronto Comic-Con, which has a large audience that goes to it, both of them have good crowds, but if it's ready for the new year, I mean, you're good to go.
Yeah, well, like, that's the plan. So I just gotta put my head down and get it done. Well, but I want to have a story in the new Raid anthology, because I haven't been any of them yet. I want to have.
And those are yearly, right?
No, Raid, they've been doing them twice a year. And actually, just the second one was really late.
Okay.
But then the third one came like right after. Yeah. I want to do a story for the Raid anthology. I want to have a draw story in the next Cauldron book, which I have everything plotted out. I just got to, like, draw it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I'm working on other stuff, too.
You got a couple, what do they call it, things in the fire?
Yeah. In the hopper?
Yeah. Well, can you tell us about the Morris story? Is there anything you can give us to anticipate it?
No.
Nothing.
I'm trying to think, because, like... I don't like to, like, sell something until it's, like, ready to be told. You know what I mean?
But
like,
the story is...
No, I know, but I still got to do it and get it done. Like, okay. I feel like I should just, like, I don't know. I don't want to be advertising something that's not ready yet.
But that'll motivate you to have it done, because you're saying it. When you put it out there, there's more of a, like, I said I would do it, I got to do it. You
know what I mean? Yeah, I disagree, though, because... Scotty Young said this on a podcast years ago that really resonated with me, and especially I think for artists that are maybe like me, like procrastinators in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about, like, when you have a story and you got to work on it, and it's better to just do it and then show people, because when I tell you about it, I'm like, oh, I got this cool idea and this. Part of me almost feels like I've told the story, so you're not as motivated to actually get it done and put it out there. Does that make sense?
It's like a
mental thing where, like,
you're
like...
I think so. I get you. Okay.
So I feel like it should just be like, I just want to... Let me show you it. You know what I mean?
Okay. You want to have something on, like, on the paper to be like, this is happening.
Yeah.
And you want to see the rest, you got to come back for it. As opposed to, like...
Or just fucking get the book done and I'll be like...
It'll get done. I think you're really going to get this...
Like, no, I'm going to get it. All I've been able to do in the past few months is just character designs and some layouts...
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of editing, because the script is by Fred Kennedy, fearless Fred Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
He's written a really good script, and it's right now I think it sits at about like 60 pages, but when I fully lay everything out, it might end up at a little bit more. I usually like to let things breathe a little bit more. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's a lot of work to do still. So,
what's your process like? We may have talked about this in the past, but now that you're doing. Something that has, it's not just like the first, what was the first Morris issue, 24 pages?
I think so.
You did issue 0 and issue 1 with
issue
combined.
Issue 0 was 16 and the first issue was, I think, 23, 24 pages.
Yeah, so combined it was like a giant size issue, if you will. Way, you know what I mean? So you did about 40 pages or so of that.
Yeah.
So when you're about to get onto a project like this where the script is done, you know, the beginning, middle, and end of the story, because there isn't going to be, like, Morris isn't going to have end to be continued in this next one. It's going to be complete. How do you go about laying out the project like that for you to set your story up?
Mostly what I do is I just, like, I'll go over the script. If this one is written by Fred, and I've changed a lot of things, so it's going to be sort of like a co-writing thing, because... there's just little things of dialogue that I want to change. Certain scenes I just kind of switch around a little bit and stuff like that. So it's not just... I'm not just taking this script and just doing it like if it's like
But it's also your character, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So. And he's open to that too, right? So, right. But the gist of his story is going to be intact. But what I usually do with like a script is I'll just like read it over and just sort of... You just kind of picture it in your head like a movie. Mm-hmm. And you kind of just, like, you know, read it over a couple of times and just keep picturing how you want it to be done. Mm-hmm. And then you do your layouts and you just little thumbnails and you try to just do little... I do really rough layouts and thumbnails because I don't want to draw it too nice there, because then I feel like sometimes I can't recreate what's on that little thumbnail. I try to recreate it and I'm like, ah, that thumbnail's got more of that energy of what I want. Right. So I try to do it just... if you see it, it's so rough. Only I can tell what's going on, and even sometimes I can't. I was like, what the hell was I doing here?
Right, right.
But yeah, I do little thumbnails.
It's just like, enough to spark that thing in your head, like, that's where I wanted to go with that. Yeah. Okay.
And what I do is I usually will go... You go page by page, but I try to do it by... Again, like in a movie, like a scene.
Right.
So it's like, okay, these first four pages, that's the opening scene of this story. So that's like, that's a focus. And you just kind of compartmentalize, like, that's that. And then what's the next scene and where does it go? Like that, basically.
Okay. Do you have a preference of, like, panel layout that you are, what's the word? Not preference, but you're partial to. I guess that's the same difference. But is there, like, you find, oh, I'm doing that layout again, this works for me, whether it's that cinematic Brian Hitch three panels down, or you know, some people are big on the 9-panel grid, which I don't think is good for everything, but is there something where you'd be like that one in the middle, two at the bottom?
No, I try to figure out what's best for the page and for what the page needs.
Okay.
And years ago I got like a portfolio review from Oliver Kuipel, who spent like a half an hour with me just going over my stuff, which was so helpful. And he basically told me, and he showed me, he was just like, look at this page here. Like, what's the most important element of this page? What do you need the eyes to be drawn to here? And it's like, why is this panel bigger when this isn't that important? What's the important part of the page here? Why is it in a tiny little panel in the corner? Like that type of thing. So he kind of just helped me to be like, okay, this is the important focus of the page. How do we draw the eyes to that? Make sure that's like the you know. And so you just kind of do what the page needs. And again, I also don't know what the hell I'm doing half the time. Like, I don't do things the proper way. But, you know, I read, Comics and Sequential Art by Will Eisner. And he breaks down, like, why you do certain panels a certain way to, like, speed up the pace of the book. And to show time in a slower or faster manner. There's tons of like great artists that do all kinds of different things. Like, I love the Brian Hitch, and when Mark Miller and Frank Quitely were doing Authority, did the same thing with that widescreen. Felt like you're watching like a widescreen movie with like, I love that. You can do that a lot of different ways, but I try to mix it up as much as possible and just do what the story needs. But again, I probably fall into the same traps and do the same kind of tricks over and over again. But it really just depends on what the story needs. And then sometimes the writer will influence that too. Like, in a thing, Fred will be like, this is a 2 double-page splash. And you're like, cool, well, that's what that is going to be, right? Like, it's, you didn't get to decide that sometimes. Or you could change it if you want, but you're like, that works really well, so.
Do you find working with a collaborator, it helps you stay on track? Or do you prefer, I'd rather just write and do it myself? Like, because when you write and do it yourself, you also got to think, should I do this? Or should I do that? Or should this be double page? Or am I making a mistake? Whereas if the guy writes it, he's like, this is this. And so you're like, all right, so I got to translate.
It depends how the writer works. Some of them will write like full script and be very detailed. And then some of them will be like, here's the script of what happens on the page and here's the dialogue. Or it'll be like, here's 6 panels, but you get to still decide how those panels are going to work and flow. I prefer working with a writer sort of co-writing in a way. Kind of like what Ricky and I always did on Black Hole Hunters, where he would write the script and then I would just change a ton of it. But the heart of what he wanted was there. But like, sometimes I'd just be like, oh, like, people don't talk like that. Like, no one actually would, like, you say it out loud and you're like, no, that sounds awkward and weird. Like, maybe they would say it like this, or they change it around. And I change stuff a lot too, to just kind of, sometimes you think you have a good script and then you read a page and as you're drawing it out, you're like, oh, I've got a better way to do this. And you just kind of tweak things a little bit, which is, I like having that freedom doing my own books. Because if you're working for the big two or something like that, or a writer that's a bit more, wants you to stick to their script exactly, then you don't have that freedom. But I don't know. I'm always just trying to figure out the best way to make it look like nice, dynamic, cool, interesting, clear. Clear is so important.
You're going to be a busy boy this year.
That's the plan.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. I'm excited.
Thanks.
And I'm really excited for Morris, because I think it's going to be really good.
Yeah.
and it's going to be a good look for both you and Fred.
Yeah.
And nice. Being in the Raid anthology, like, your name will be beside these...
Yeah.
Some you know, guys that are just getting bigger and bigger in the business. Like, Marcus yeah. Toll now, he was already established, but now he's doing this Excalibur thing, and yeah. that'll be good. So now the new schedule for you, because work and your last job was the kick-ass schedule that just didn't let you go to the studio.
No,
so now you have anything. You haven't established a little bit more of that time. What's going to be like your goal to get work in?
Well, I got to get used to it because now I'm doing mornings, which I wasn't a big morning guy.
Mm-hmm.
But before I was doing nights, and my plan was like, oh, I'll get up a bit earlier, go to the studio for a bit, and then go into work for nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never got up in time to do any art, basically. I was just exhausted all the time. But now I'm doing like 7 a.m. till 3, so I'll be done at 3 o'clock. And the plan's like to go into the studio, I don't know, I'd like to get in there 3 to 4 times a week and like really just get to work and put in some time and draw.
When you're working on... your book.
Yeah.
Do you find it's work again, like another job, or do you find this is the outlet that you need, even though it's tiring and it requires sacrifice? Is there the joy? Like, this is where you find the joy?
It's both. It's definitely work, but there's a lot more pride and joy. When you're done, like when you're working for someone else, like, you know, the same thing. You do a day job and you're like, you're working for somebody else.
Yeah.
It's not as good.
Yeah.
You're doing it because they pay you, but you're not like sitting back going like, fuck, look at this, I'm so good. But when you do your own work and your project, you're like, for sure it's work. But when you, like, there's sometimes you finish a page or a panel and you're just like, yeah. Like
that felt good.
And it's cool growing and evolving because sometimes you take note of that and you do this little happy accident. And you're like, whoa, I just discovered something. Like I now know how to do that better and I know how to be, and you can almost feel like, you've slightly become a better artist bit by bit each time that happens.
That's thrill, though. It makes you want to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're just like, it gets you excited to do it and try different tricks. And also, like, being in the studio, what little I've been in there, like, I'm next to Scott Hepburn, who's one of my favorite artists. And he's so, like, so supportive and always, like, tries to give me advice on how to fix things and do things better. And I was like, that happens the little time I've been there. Like, imagine if I was there all the time. I pick up so much more of like what he's doing and just seeing what he's doing. And
I think it'll be addictive.
I think so. Yeah.
It won't be like, oh, I gotta go to the studio and work on this book, especially because it's your baby. Like,
exactly. And just seeing all the other guys at the studio always being so productive and creative, and like Kyle James Smith just working on his webcomic and doing his like witch drawings and his sketchbook thing that he does. And you're like, it's just cool to see inspiring. Creative people. Yeah, it's so inspiring.
Yeah, I think when you are attempting at creating things, because I think everybody is creative in some way, they just haven't tapped into it yet, but when you know what your creative thing is, like when my buddy sends me something that he wrote in a song, that's what makes me want to, because usually it's harder for me to be like, what am I gonna, I don't know what to talk about, I don't know what to do. So when you're around other artists, you're like, oh, look at that, like, I'm gonna go and do something now. It's not competitive, but it kind of, that competitive spirit of like, you did something good in the game, well, I got to contribute.
To the
universe of ideas.
For me, it's not competitive at all. It's inspiring. It's like, it's like, holy fuck, look what they did. I gotta be better. I gotta keep working at this. How do I get to that level? How do I keep getting them like better and better?
Yeah, it's not that competitiveness of like, oh, I gotta be better than that guy so he doesn't have a job. But if he did well, I can do well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, being at the studio.
So what do they say? It's a rising tide raises all ships, like that type of thing.
Should be. Should be, yeah, for sure. That's good, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So what else is happening in your life? Anything that you're enjoying reading other than all the work that you've been into? What are you enjoying doing right now?
I'm reading, what's that book called? Catch as Catch Can. It's by Joseph Heller.
Uh-huh.
He wrote Catch 22, which is my favorite book of all time. And I've been on this Catch-22 kick again, because I haven't read it in a while, so I reread it recently. And they just came out with a Hulu series. It was like a 6-part Hulu series of Catch-22.
Seriously?
It had like George Clooney and... who's the guy that plays House? The actor?
Oh, I don't remember his name.
Joe House? Dr. House?
Okay.
Whatever, he's in it. I think Clooney like produced it or something like that, but...
I gotta read that book.
Yeah, you gotta read the book, because I've watched the movie that they made in the 70s based on it, and I watched this series, And, like, they get a lot of things right, but there's just something missing when they translate it from a book.
There's certain nuances that just can't be,
but especially for Catch-22, because Catch-22 is, it's so brilliant, it's so clever. There's moments where it's, like, ridiculous and slapstick, like Three Stooges, and then there's these moments of, like, black humor, and then there's, like, horror almost in it, and you're, like, this horrific visuals. And it's just, it's hard to translate that into a show or a movie where people are expecting one thing. I always found black humor doesn't translate as well in, like, movies and TV. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But when you read it in a book, like, it seems to hit home a little bit more. It just seems to make more sense.
Because sometimes things that you read in a book, even though there's nothing visual about it, you can relate to having lived. Because a lot of times it's written as though it's been lived.
Yeah.
And you can't always recreate that in a scene for scene moment where a story's supposed to be told.
Yeah.
Because sometimes in life, the moment you live, you can't translate it into another story for people to see it. You gotta live in that moment, feel it.
Yeah.
Right? And I think sometimes literature allows that to happen.
Yeah.
And when you try to, this is black humor, but it's also slapstick. All at the same time, it's jarring.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Well, Catch-22 is my favorite book ever. I've never read something that I love as much. Mm-hmm. I can open it to, like, any page and start reading.
Did you love it the very first time you read it?
The first chapter I read, it's like it opens in a hospital. And I was just like, what is this? And then immediately I was just like, this is fucking brilliant. Like, everything about this is so ridiculous and amazing. Like, it's so stupid, but it's brilliant at the same time.
Mm.
And then, I watched the movie, I watched the series, and then I just discovered that I didn't know. The thing is, like, I love this book so much, I've never considered reading anything else by the author.
Mm-hmm.
So I found out that he has a sort of a sequel to it called Closing Time, and it's set, like, I don't know, it's like 40 or 50 years after the World War II, and has some of the characters from Catch-22, and I was like, oh, God, there's a sequel. I could read that. And then I just discovered at BMV the other day that there is a book called Catch as Catch Can. It's just a collection of short stories he did. And I've read three of them so far, and it's so good. And some of them apparently involve some of the characters from Catch-22, like, in sort of weird different ways. So, yeah, that's my new favorite thing is new Joseph Heller books.
That's good.
Old Joseph Heller books.
I got to get back into reading, like, prose novels. I haven't read one for a long time. But I feel if I were riding the train to work, I'd probably be more prone to bringing a book with me. Whereas when I got, like, reading a comic, I feel like in 20 minutes I can read that more story.
Yeah.
And because you intend to talk to people eventually about their work, you want to have read it, which doesn't always pan out the way you think. But yeah, I'd like to get back into reading. I have it on my shelf, Catch-22. I've always meant to read it. I got to do it. Just do it. Just screw comic books.
Get into it and skip whatever. There's always like an anniversary edition that has like a big long foreword or prologue. Just skip to the first chapter.
Just read the book.
The first chapter I think is called The Texan.
Okay.
And it opens in the hospital. Just read that. And if you're not like... Honestly, I feel like if you're not into it by the end of that chapter, you're not going to really, like, get it. Like, it's just so fucking stupid and great.
And I think that's part of what... Some things you got to read at the right time.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go into it having read something else and thinking that that's going to fill that void of what you're looking for next, and you don't get it at the right time, you miss the whole value of the book. Yeah. And that seems like a very nuanced book. It's not just your typical novel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the way you're describing it, it's like it's so ridiculous and then so brilliant all at the same time.
Yeah, it really is.
Cool.
Yeah, and I feel like one thing that I always find with the translation of the movie and then this TV series is that they always end up, it really shows like a sort of, hits you at home with like the realities of war because it's set during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character is Yossarian, this pilot who just doesn't want to fly any more missions. And he's just trying to get out of doing his duty to go home. And every time he gets close to finishing the missions that he can do, they raise the number. So he can never actually finish them and go home.
Mm.
And it just always ends up going darker. And then you end up left with this like really like pessimistic, horrible feeling. Whereas the book doesn't do that. The book leaves you sort of like, there's definitely awful things that happen in it. But I think by the end, you're like, you kind of start feeling better about the situation. And like, I don't know. It's really good.
It's like you carry on, even though things get dark and things get bad, you find a way to keep going.
Yeah.
Keep living. Yeah, got you. I just finished Murder Falcon.
Oh, yeah.
The graphic novel. It was tremendous.
So is that 8 issues in that?
8 issues.
Okay.
And what was cool about it, which is it's not so novel, but at the same time, you don't always see it anymore, especially when things are issued or like they're released in single issues, is the book reads as one full story. There's never that break of end of issue 1, now we're in issue 2. You just read it, and then all the covers are at the end of the book where you see
what
the covers and variant covers were, but the story itself just reads all the way through, real not thorough, that's not the right word, but it's got like this nice symmetry all the way from beginning to end, and it has a lot of heart to it, because it's a pretty ridiculous premise in a way, but it's so cool.
Because we were obviously big Dan and Warren Johnson fans.
And that's because I give you credit for that, because you...
Well, I loved Extremity. I loved Extremity.
Yeah, Extremity was very
good. And then when I started reading Murder Falcon, so like I was telling Eric earlier, I read issues 1 and 2, and then I couldn't find 3, so I just bought 4 and 5. I just skipped 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read like issue 8 or something like that. So I've read a bunch of them out of order.
So you read issue 8?
I think so. I have to double check. I've read... After 5, I read... There's, like, one more issue I read. But it may not be 8. But I don't know. Whatever. I was buying the single issues because I wanted to support the series, but I actually was just waiting for the trade to come out, which I haven't got yet. But I remember reading it and being like, this is a very ridiculous premise and plot. But he executes it so well.
Yeah.
And it's literally... I didn't think I was going to like it more than Extremity, and it quickly became... It's already one of my all-time favorite books. Like, I'm just reading it, and I'm just like, this plot is so silly, and anyone else would have not done it justice, and he just executes it perfectly. I said, what do you think of Murder Falcon? I don't even know what that is.
We're back. We had a slight edit that we needed to make.
Now we're back.
Because Daph J needed to ask us a question.
Daph J doesn't like Murder Falcon.
I think she would, but anyways, getting back to what you were saying about it being pretty much perfect. I love how Daniel Warren Johnson, we always have to say all three names, right?
D-Dub-J.
How he takes some sort of artistic metaphor of whether it's drawing or in this case music and uses it to really express how to get through things in life using those methods, like what they add to our lives in order to cope and to overcome whatever horrible things we're going through. And it seems so bombastic how he does it in this one, but yeah, it makes perfect sense. Like, I read the last issue actually playing, like, Dragon Force in the background just to get, like, the full effect like, the main character playing the guitar.
What's the band called? Bruticus?
His former band, Bruticus? Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah, that's great.
And even just, like, the concept of... This character, the Murder Falcon, who just appears, it seems so random.
Yeah.
But as you're reading it, it just gets better and better and better.
Yeah.
And it has a little bit of that 90s aesthetic a little bit, where he's got like pouches and a metal arm that transforms into different stuff. So all those comic book tropes of that era that seem like, so dumb, but it's so beautifully done.
I love it.
Yeah, I loved it too.
Yeah.
Highly recommend Murder Falcon to anybody listening to the show. Both me and Shane put it in our 2 thumbs up.
Yeah, I gotta get the trade.
Yeah, the trade's a nice. It's a nice package.
Martin's got to get on it too. He just got it on Comixology, he said.
Yeah, he said he bought it digitally.
Yeah,
we'll do a book club for it.
We'll do a book club.
Sounds good. Well, thank you, dude, for coming by and being on the show and telling us all the things that are happening with Cauldron and looking forward to Morris. And anything else that you want to tell us about? Plug? Nothing. Tell us where we can support Cauldron one more time.
Go to Kickstarter, look for Cauldron Fall 2019 issue, and then you'll.
And it should be up on September 3rd or 4th.
Yeah, tomorrow's the 3rd. It'll be up by tomorrow or the next day. So by the time this comes out, it should be rocking and rolling. Goal's gonna be like before $1,000, which we both times we hit within like hours, which is always good. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
And then it'll be released will there be an event that it'll be released at?
So with the first one, we wanted it out for Fan Expo, but because this year we were so busy, we just didn't get it done in time. So we're going to try, but we figure it fits maybe a bit more of like that Halloween theme anyway.
Okay.
So we're going to try and get the Kickstarter should be done like end of September, and the book should be out for Halloween. That's the plan. So I'm not sure what kind of, I know we're doing like, I think there's a con called Frightmare in the Falls. It's like a horror fest. And then there's that Halloween comic fest at Gotham, which I know a bunch of the guys will be there. So I think that weekend we'll have the book ready to go.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Shane, for coming back on the show. Well, next time you come back, we'll either do a book club or some type of top five. And you can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Yeah. Follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and leave us a review on iTunes. Thank you again, everybody, for listening, and we will be back soon.